From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Celeste Headley. Did stories of sexual harassment and assault flood your social media feed this week?
I am myself a survivor, a rape survivor, and the recent Me Too project really kind of opened my eyes to maybe how little people really do understand the pervasiveness of this, even in a state like Georgia or nationally.
That's Atlanta artist Jessica Caldas. We'll get more perspectives of Georgians on the Me Too hashtag ahead this hour. But first, yesterday, self-described white nationalist Richard Spencer spoke at the University of Florida in Gainesville. Florida Governor Rick Scott declared a state of emergency to prepare law enforcement for potentially violent protests. Aside from a few reported punches, the protests occurred without much fuss. We've talked about how universities should handle controversial speakers.
We encourage students to be not harmful to each other. We encourage students to be respectful of each other. So it's a value incongruence to bring speakers who don't actually do that, who don't actually live by that ethos.
That's Kijua Sanders McMurtry speaking for Agnes Scott College in Decatur. Here are your first thoughts.
Since in East Cobb, I am a proud Auburn alumni and also a conservative and a minority. I want to respect people's rights to be able to speak freely on a college campus. However, I think inviting Richard Spencer to Auburn, I think we kind of towed the line there. His speech is disgusting, it's hateful, and frankly, I don't tolerate it.
Carly McMinn writes us about uninvited speakers on her campus. We had a man preaching at students, telling women in dresses and skirts that they're going to hell. There was also a pro-life group putting graphic images about abortion in a busy area. Both instances were very aggressive and possibly hurtful examples of free speech. Where do we draw the line for the sake of students' mental health? Good question. We always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Does the following sequence of characters mean anything to you? MST3K. Imagine being in outer space with two sassy robots and being forced to watch really bad science fiction movies with them. Just how bad? That's a clip from the TV series Mystery Science Theater 3000, MST3K. It was a big cult hit, and it just vanished about 15 years ago. Now, thanks to Netflix and a big crowdfunding campaign, it is back. MST3K brought a live show to Atlanta this summer, and that's when I caught up with the show's creator, Joel Hodgson.
For anyone listening who has never seen Mystery Science Theater 3000, could you briefly summarize the completely bonkers premise of your program?
Well, normally, if I'm sitting next to somebody on a plane and the conversation goes to what I do, I tend to bring out my sketchbook and I'll draw a picture of a movie screen and little theater seats with three characters, a man and two robots, that talk during the movie. And most people, when they see that, they'll go, oh, right, that. And they get to it. And so that's usually how I explain it, because sometimes, you know, the way people, it's really hard to explain, I think, if you have, that's why I made it into a TV show, so I wouldn't have to explain it.
But there is a premise behind it. It's not just a couple of silhouetted figures watching old movies in the public domain so that you don't have to pay for them and making fun of them.
Yeah, there's a narrative there where it's very loose, but the mad scientists are trying to find the worst movie ever made, and they keep screening them, hoping to kind of break our hero, which is Jonah Heston. And he's got a couple of robot companions that hang out with him and watch the movies with him and talk.
Let's listen to a little clip from the debut episode.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Satellite of Love. I'm Joel Robinson, and these
are... Oh, you see, he introduced himself. What a perfectly thoughtful thing to do.
Yes, these are my robots, Tom Servo and Crew, and I've installed in them a protocol module that makes them believe everything I think, say, or do is utterly brilliant.
Oh, and it is Joel. God, yes. Oh,
Roger
Joel.
Penrose on his best day isn't half as brilliant or as charming as you, I might add.
Okay. So to recap, Joel, Mystery Science Theater 3000 is a show in which the hero of the program has been imprisoned by mad scientists on a spaceship called the Satellite of Love. These mad scientists are trying to find the worst movie ever so that they can drive humanity mad with it, I guess, and conquer the world. They are forcing our hero in this in the early iterations of the program, it's you, Joel, forcing our hero to watch a succession of terrible films. Our hero has built two robots to keep him company and help him snark and make fun of the movies, thus immunizing him from the maddening effects of said films. This debuted on a local station in Minneapolis-St. Paul in the late 80s. How did you ever convince a succession of television executives that this was a marketable idea?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think originally when I got to the idea, I thought it would be really hard to do because this is 1988 and almost 30 years ago, and there was no such thing as creating a TV show where the performers and the audience share the same screen. And I didn't think anyone would let me do it. My first position was, I know about these public domain movies that are like adorable and like Robot Monster and Plan 9 from Outer Space. But I quickly found out you can't really just use public domain movies. They have to be licensed because, you know, someone has to maintain the print. And so we pretty much have to license everything. And my first position was what was the cheapest show I could make, because I didn't trust my ability to talk executives into anything, and I felt that I could talk an audience into something. So I started out by making Mystery Science Theater, which was the cheapest show I could think of, because I thought it would be fueled with public domain movies, and all we would need is a green screen and a little set, and we'd be able to make it. So that was my first position, and that's how we did it. We got it on a local UHF channel. We started a fan club. We started to get press, and so we had this really nice package of about 8 minutes of our funniest riffs. And I went to Comedy Channel, which became Comedy Central, and I pitched it to a guy I knew there named Stu Smiley, who was the head of Comedy Channel. And so we had a pretty compelling package with good press, good local press from Minneapolis, and 8 minutes of our funniest stuff. So that's kind of how I did it. And then it just kind of went from there. Once they put it on Comedy Channel, I didn't have to do anything. It kind of took care of itself.
The bulk of the program is our hero and his two robot pals just looking up at that screen along with the audience, watching this some silly old film and snarking on it. There are interstitial sketches in between, but the bulk of the programming is just the fellow and the robots snarking at an old movie. So let's listen to a couple of clips from a 1997 episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000. This is in which the MST gang is watching and commenting on a 1975 low-budget sci-fi film called The Giant Spider Invasion.
Does it matter that the spider ate him with his butt?
No, I think it seems suitable for this guy.
Can you imagine how many interns it took to pull that guy up into the spider?
And just when things were really looking up for her.
Any of you ladybugs have any comments about the spider?
No, it's spider season and we didn't wear orange.
That's a clip from Mystery Science Theater 3000. We are speaking to its creator, Joel Hodgson. Mystery Science Theater 3000 is back on Netflix. Joel, it strikes me when I watch Mystery Science Theater 3000 now, I mean, I watched it a lot in high school in the 90s when I was a kid, but when I was sort of rewatching it again to get ready to talk to you, it was just amazing to me how much this program that you made prior to the explosion of the internet really anticipated much of internet culture, the recapping of other culture, running commentary. There's YouTubers who basically do what you did 20 years ago, where they just watch something along with the audience and comment on it. What do you make of that parallelism?
Well, I appreciate you noticing that. I think in a weird way we did anticipate some of it, and I think that comes from the theory of a shared screen. And it was very hard to do when we started. It was unheard of, and that's why I had to start at the bottom pretty much and start with at a UHF channel. I really didn't think I could go to a network and get anyone to, you know, buy into it. But I think it really comes from sharing a screen, and now we all share screens, and so that's just a natural kind of position for us to be in. I think Mystery Science Theater is the first show that may have done that. I can't think of other ones where the audience and the comics are like looking at the same thing and participating because they're sharing that. Other than that, it was just a happy accident. And the other thing about movie riffing is the other important thing is that it happened right at the beginning of cable, and cable had an immense amount, a big hunger to fill with content. And our show was 90 minutes long and very refillable. We did almost 200 episodes on cable. And because it was kind of unheard of, we weren't really like trying to emulate any shows. So we just filled it with whatever we felt like it and kind of pleased ourselves. And that was the other piece of it, is we never thought, who's going to get this? We just always said the right people will get it. And I think that really fits in with, social media culture now.
That's Joel Hodgson, creator of Mystery Science Theater 3000. We have been airing our best conversations in celebration of this show's third birthday. If you have a favorite OST segment, let us know, tweet us, or leave us a message at 404-594-57. Just ahead, the Break Room gets excited about the Star Wars Han Solo movie. But first, Atlanta activists on why we should listen to the Me Too phenomenon. It's on Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. Over the last week, stories about sexual assault and harassment have flooded social media with the Me Too hashtag. It is meant to raise awareness about these abuses in the wake of allegations against film producer Harvey Weinstein. Atlanta-based artist Jessica Caldas deals with sexual assault in much of her work. She admits that she hesitated to share the Me Too hashtag.
My name is Jessica Caldas, and I am an artist and activist living here in the city of Atlanta. I am myself a survivor, a rape survivor, and it's hard for me to have a clear vision of whether or not sexual assault is getting enough attention in Georgia because I'm so entrenched in the issue. But I think something like the recent Me Too project really kind of opened my eyes to maybe how little people really do understand the pervasiveness of this, even in a state like Georgia or nationally. I think awareness campaigns are super important. Obviously, it's the first step to solving any problem is making sure people understand that the problem exists and the degree to which it exists. But I think there's, of course, two things that kind of go hand in hand with that. The first, especially when you're talking about really heavy issues, things that deal with trauma and people's personal stories, like you have to be really careful that while you're attempting to help the community that you're talking about, that you're not burdening them further. And that's a really difficult line to walk. Sharing a story of sexual assault or domestic violence or any kind of trauma like that can be very empowering, but it's a very personal choice to have to make as a survivor. I know I spent some time on Monday just checking in with folks that I knew, like some of them had shared the hashtag, some of them hadn't, but it was more just like, I know that seeing this barrage of stories is a little overwhelming. Even for me personally, I sort of like had to check out of, you know, like social media for half the day, even though like it's a topic that I really care about and that I engage with regularly, because it definitely kind of makes you feel powerless in a way that is not as healthy as you would like it to be. And then the other part of it is I think that, again, awareness is very important and a great first step, but I think what can make it even more powerful is being sure that there's some kind of action happening as well. And I saw a lot of people posting things like, I believe you, or sympathy towards the people saying me too. And those are really great first steps. But that's a bare minimum. Like, believing someone is very important, but that should be something that we assume is going to happen. What we need is for people to act on that belief. When they hear stories of somebody acting inappropriately, especially if it's a friend of theirs or somebody they work with, they need to feel empowered and feel like they should go approach that person and confront them and ask about what happened and challenge them on it. If they step up, if they challenge others, then that behavior is less likely to continue. And I think that is something I would have liked to see more, as sort of a pledge towards that kind of action.
That's Atlanta-based artist Jessica Caldas. We also talked about this with local LGBT activist and Breakroom regular Robbie Medwed. Here's his reaction to the Me Too movement.
My week, like so many others, started with hundreds of women saying Me Too. The echo was nearly universal. For 2 days, nearly every single post on my social media feed was someone telling their story of sexual harassment or sexual assault. It was gut-wrenching, and it was upsetting, and it was more shocking than I'd like to admit. But just as I was starting to process that far more women than I'd ever imagined had to deal with sexual harassment and sexual assault at levels far higher than I'd ever considered, I read a Twitter thread from my friend Rabbi Danya Ruttenberg that knocked the wind right out of me. She began with a simple plea: please don't make marginalized people do all the work. The power of Me Too was found in women telling their own stories, but it was also a double-edged sword. Suddenly, men were expecting women not only to recall terrible moments and relive them, but to lead the fight themselves. When we asked, what can I do, we didn't realize that we were asking those who were already exhausted from the fight to do the work that is ours to do. We didn't realize that the plague of sexual harassment and sexual assault was ours to solve, not theirs. Sure, some of us were lucky. Some of us were given concrete answers that we could learn from and build upon by incredibly generous women who were willing to share their painful stories in order that it might inspire us to make change. We were given clear instructions. Believe women when they tell their stories. And when we're lucky enough to hear their stories, shut up and listen. By the end of the week, it was clear we hadn't been listening at all. We sat back and watched as our women colleagues, family, and friends fought off trolls and doubters and called out so many men on their bad behavior, and we stayed quiet. We told ourselves that it wouldn't be polite to interfere. We convinced ourselves it wasn't our fight. Almost as soon as we had finished saying the words, I hear you and I believe you, we let our friends and loved ones down. The Me Too campaign will only work if men make it work. Danya spelled it out on her thread. It's not the job of women to stop sexual assault. It's not the job of any marginalized person to stop oppression. Those of us with privilege and power have a responsibility to speak up and speak out, even when, and especially when, It makes us uncomfortable to do so. It's our job to put an end to this, and our job alone.
That is educator and LGBT activist Robbie Medwed. If you have thoughts about the Me Too movement, let us know. Post to Facebook or Twitter. We're at OST Talk. Or give us a call and leave a message, 404-500-9457. It's been another long week. We have discussed the philosophy of sports. We have raised a lot of money for GPB. Thanks everyone who called in and pledged. We've also celebrated the third birthday of On Second Thought. So as we do every Friday, we've gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and think about what happened this week. It is time for the break room.
It's the battle of the ages. 12 rounds of boxing for the heavyweight championship of the world.
Sounded like a lovely woman, did not say what the congresswoman said, and most people aren't too surprised to hear that.
What happens now determines what happens to the rest of the world.
All right, let's talk about all of those stories and more. Joining us in the break room are, let's have people introduce themselves. Natalie, you go first.
Hi, I'm Natalie Pavelski. I'm a vice president with Cater Communications.
Steve?
Hi, Steve Brown, Fayette County Commissioner, Fayette County Board of Commissioners.
Hey, I'm Donnie Leapard, a television and film editor here in Atlanta, Georgia.
And I'm Kalina Bowler. I am host of the Credits Podcast.
Lovely to have all of you to discuss the week's news. In our last segment, we were hearing from local activists about the social media Me Too campaign. And while many folks are speaking out against Harvey Weinstein and sexual assault, filmmaker Woody Allen called the effort, quote, a witch hunt. In an interview with the BBC, Woody Allen said to beware of, quote, a Salem atmosphere where every guy in an office who winks at a woman is suddenly having to call a lawyer to defend himself. That's not right either, end quote. Thus spoke Woody Allen. What do we think of Woody Allen's idea that people are overreacting here? Kalina?
Nobody is overreacting. This is a rampant problem. I found myself in a lot of Facebook posts with a lot of fellow filmmakers, and we were really discussing, you know, honestly, what do we do? Because sometimes the assault comes from people above the line. That could be like producers, writers, directors, and then we feel like we don't have a lot of, you know, recourse or something, somebody we can go and talk to. And there's not a lot of companies that have an immediate HR department. So it's one of those things where you really have to consider that people who are assaulted or harassed in this way, this is something that is hurtful and is something that is a power play. And for Woody Allen to come and say, you know, oh, we need to make sure these women don't get out of hand, like, that is so, so distasteful. So distasteful. That's horrible.
Go ahead, Natalie.
I mean, first of all, Woody Allen has zero standing to comment
exactly
on this. I mean, who's next, Bill Cosby? But second, it's not an overreaction, and I think it's a broader issue than just the film industry. I mean, as you sow, shall you reap, right? And Harvey Weinstein over the years has treated women and other people awfully for a very long time. And I think there's also a lot of women out there who are tired of rich and powerful men thinking they can just grab women by the, okay, I won't go there. And a lot of people are sick of it. And so I think that's part of what this is tapping into.
That said, I mean, it could be the case that sexual assault and harassment is a rampant viral problem in the movie industry, and at the same time, there could now be an overcorrection, something along the lines that Woody Allen fears, though he is hardly the ideal messenger for that message. Both of those things could possibly be true at the same time. Donnie, do you think there is the potential for an overreaction in Hollywood? You're a filmmaker yourself.
Just playing devil's advocate, I feel like there is, at times, there can be a social media mob, like, you know, mentality, and there's very selectivity in who to go after and who not to. Like, they give Casey Affleck an Oscar, you know, and even our own president gets a pass for a lot of inappropriate comments and behavior. So there can be some possibility for that to occur, and it could be a situation where it's like, we don't like this particular person at this time, so everyone will focus their attention on trying to bring them down.
Right. And Steve, do we think that in a situation like that are basically all of the guilty, many guilty parties are out there trying to kind of pool their guilt into one sacrificial lamb and then they kill the lamb and they figure it's done with?
Well, I mean, you know, there is that philosophy that if you do away with Harvey Weinstein, everything is better. But, I mean, obviously the movement behind that has shown that that's not going to go away. But, you know, to Donnie's point is, you know, the objectivity is what is really needed here. And you don't want to cause damage that, you know, is unnecessary, and you do want to make sure that you're rectifying the problem. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to let anger and over emotions get into the thing where you start whitewashing everything and you cause more problems than you had before.
I think the timing of his statement is what is it stings, because right now the focus is this guy is a serial predator and he's done so much damage for so many years that has been unchecked. And suddenly, as we're getting right into the meat of it, you know, ladies, let's chill. You know, like, no.
Right. And the messenger can be as important as the message. I mean, of all the people in the world to tell me, now be careful, ladies, you know, is Woody Allen the right person to deliver that message?
No, he is not.
Right. There's no
Seems
doubt
to be
about
consensus
that.
On that topic. All right, let's stay with Hollywood before we have to go to our break, but let's talk about some more fun stuff. A lot of people are getting pumped for the new Star Wars film.
I've seen this raw strength only once before. It didn't scare me enough then. It does now.
That is a clip from the upcoming Star Wars film, The Last Jedi. But this week, another Star Wars spinoff was announced, or at least its title was announced. The new Han Solo prequel will be called Solo, a Star Wars story. So, question, bland title or tantalizingly vague, Donnie?
I was very disappointed by this because it is as the title is as bland as I feel the director is. So,
oh my God.
I wasn't really.
How do you really feel?
I wasn't really sure why they brought Ron Howard in, you know, to do the pickup shoots for this movie, because he isn't really known for science fiction and fantasy and epic adventures.
He did The Grinch.
Yeah, I'll give him that. That's one.
I like The Grinch.
So yeah, you need to think of J.J. Abrams as the cleanup man these type of franchises. So I'm very anxious to see how this movie does. I don't know.
Kalina?
Okay, look. So Han Solo, his character was amazing in the original iterations of the original series of Star Wars. We have, is it Donald Glover? Is that who is going to be?
No.
Lando Calrissian.
I'm sorry. That's correct. You're right. So clearly I'm not paying attention to it. So it's not on my radar, to be honest. So I just, you know.
Well, from what I've read, they basically reshot almost the whole movie. And
wow.
Certain actors like Michael K. Williams could not reprise their roles to do the pickup shoot, so they recast his character because he had a scheduling conflict.
Wow.
So this is a completely different movie, and it's a Ron Howard movie, essentially. I'm curious to see who the directed by credit is going to go to. It's going to be an interesting time when the movie comes out.
And you know, the interesting thing is, Adam, that most of these Star Wars movies, if you look at the titles, you know, Return of the Jedi and The Empire Strikes Back and The Phantom Menace and Revenge of the Sith, they all tell you what's coming. Mm. You know, you've got these big, you know, things that are going to happen, challenges, battles, intrigue. Han Solo, a story. You know, I mean, I'm like, where are we?
Well, they kind of did that with Rogue One as well. But Rogue
Which
One
I thought
awesome.
Was like the best Star Wars film since the first two.
Oh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's an opinion.
I agree.
It's the hottest of takes.
Right?
Oh, boy. Okay, we have like 1 minute to get through one more topic, and let's see if we can do it really quickly. The Black Panther movie is coming. Here's a clip.
Task Force will decide who brings in Barnes.
Don't bother Ms. Romanoff. I'll kill him myself.
Chadwick Boseman as the Black Panther in Captain America: Civil War. Black Panther is now going to get his own movie filmed in Atlanta. After decades of trying to nail the modern black superhero, we may finally be getting what we've asked for and getting it done right. Do we think that this represents a shift for in the favor of more diverse superheroes and could continue beyond Black Panther? I think that a couple of people in the room there are more qualified than others to comment on that question.
Yeah, think.
What are you trying to say? No, I'm just playing. But I mean, my social media has been rife with posts about how excited I am about this new Black Panther film. I'm picking out my day one outfit now.
Ooh,
I'm going to have, it's going to be Coming to America meets, like, you know what I mean? I mean, I'm going to be a Wakandan princess goddess thing. My hair's going to be so big, no one can see past it.
We're not sitting behind Kalina.
Right. It's going to be so great.
All right. Fair to say it sounds like we are excited, and that is just fantastic. Okay, so it's Friday. We're in the break room. Just ahead, is Georgia ready for high-speed rail, and where would it go? Also, the South's most notorious jewel thief is calling it quits, or is she? It is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. We're back with the break room in just a moment. It's Adam Ragusea. It is Adam Ragusea. The show, however, is called On Second Thought. I am Adam Ragusea, and I'm in for Celeste Headlee. We are having coffee and conversation in the break room, as we do each Friday. My guests are Donnie Liepart, filmmaker and longtime employee of Videodrome, Natalie Pavelski, vice president of Cater Communications, Fayette County Commissioner Steve Brown, and Kalina Bowler, host of the Credits podcast. Let's talk about some more stuff from the news. This is maybe my favorite story of the week. Jewel thief Doris Payne of Atlanta has been stealing for more than seven decades. She has reportedly lifted $2+ million worth of valuables in her lifetime. Here she is speaking with Fox 5 after being caught in Dunwoody last year.
Being a thief ain't the worst thing you can be.
Would you say you're more than what people may think you are?
I don't care what people think I am. Get that. You're not listening. I don't care. I know. It don't matter. It never has.
Doris Payne was caught again this week stealing at Walmart. She told a judge that she would not be coming back to the courtroom. So, Natalie, do we think that that means that Doris Payne is retiring her jewel thievery forever, or is she just saying that she does not intend to get caught again?
I think it's the latter. And the thing is, it's sad because I think she might end up ending her career at Walmart, and this is a woman who's stolen from some much nicer places.
How sad.
Yeah, I don't know. I think she will, I hope she won't thieve again because I'd hate to see her end up in jail or in prison, but I'm not holding my breath.
am I wrong for thinking that this woman is kind of awesome? I mean, ultimately, like, she is a thief, right, Steve? It's not cool to steal.
The first time she was nabbed as a senior citizen, I think there was a lot of allure around this because, you know, her story came back. You know, it was in the newspapers, it was on television, and it was like, wow, this is like old school, you know, jewel thievery and stuff like this, and she still got it and stuff like this. But then when you get caught shoplifting at Walmart, it just puts a whole different, you know, perspective on it. And I think, you know, it's kind of like, you know, now she's just kind of doing it to exist, and it's kind of sad now.
I don't know. At 87 years old, I feel like it's baked into the cake at this point. It's in her blood.
Can't change who you are at that
age. Yeah, no. As we say in Detroit, she's married to the game. Like, till death do us part, that type of thing.
I like it.
Yeah.
I like it.
All right. Let's talk about something else that's kind of old-timey. Time was boxing was America's biggest sport.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, from Donald Trump's Trump Plaza Hotel Casino here on the boardwalk in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Let's get ready to rumble!
Oh, Donald Trump permeates our history in some ways. But that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is boxing. Evander Holyfield will soon have a statue in downtown Atlanta to honor his incredible boxing career. Some folks are saying it's sort of a little unfortunate that it's coming now at a time when boxing is seen as being on the decline, or at least the popularity of boxing. Any boxing fans in the room?
You know, I have a great appreciation of boxing, and I love Evander Holyfield, Fayette County citizen, by the way, and longtime Fayette County citizen. And, you know, he's one of the nicest sweetest people you will ever meet to be in one of the blood sports. I mean, he is, but he is just a classic good human being. He's had some misfortune in his life, in the latter part of his career, but really nice guy, very deserving of the statue, and I couldn't be happier for him.
Yeah. He harkens back to a time, I think, I remember when I was a kid, sports, they used to have storylines and rivalries, and nowadays I don't really feel that, especially like with the NBA and a little bit with the MLB, but not so much anymore. And boxing was one of those sports where you had, they were personalities and they had a certain, you know, charisma, et cetera. Nowadays, I guess Floyd Mayweather is the only one.
Yeah.
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 In terms of charisma, Mayweather can't touch Holyfield exactly. In any way. It's in my opinion. And I completely agree with you 100%. Sweet guy. There was something about him in the ring. I mean, he would just go for it and go for it and go for it. You know what I mean? And I just really enjoyed watching him fight. Yeah. You know, he was great.
I think this is one more example of audience fragmentation, though. I think it's hard for boxing to compete with mixed martial arts, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
MMA is huge. Yeah. All the younger generation is picking up on MMA. And I think it's really taking boxing and just kind of setting it to the side. But there's so much grassroots support. And MMA was a grassroots athletic event for many, many years until it finally gained public acceptance.
Yeah. I blame Tekken, Mortal Kombat, and any Steven Seagal movie that's coming out.
I would like to blame Steven Seagal for everything. Moving on to something that I don't think that we can pin on Steven Seagal. This week, a Georgia woman claimed that Delta did not let her sing the national anthem on a Delta flight because it violated policy. Delta has since said that the flight attendant who made this woman stop singing was misinformed and that singing the anthem does not violate any airline policy. This has led to a significant backlash, predictably, against Delta. On the other hand, Kalina, I kind of feel like I wouldn't want anyone to just start singing on the airplane. Like, it doesn't matter what song they're singing, right?
I am with you 100%. I'm just trying to get to my destination as quickly and as quietly as possible. Please, please be quiet on the plane. You could, I mean...
I agree. And we
don't get her started.
Right? Yeah.
We don't know if this woman could actually sing. Like, was she really, really singing? Or was she just awkwardly singing?
But even if she was singing, like, just don't bust out singing anything, even if you can blow like Whitney Houston on my flight to San Francisco. Just don't.
Well, yeah. And, you know, I think she had really good intentions. I think I'll give her that. But Delta, I think, cleaned it up really well. And they said, look, that's not our policy and whatnot. But, you know, Delta has an honor guard. And I don't know if any of you all have ever seen that. But when they're taking a casket off of an aircraft of a service person killed in the line of duty, they stand there, they have the flags and everything. And these are Delta employees who are doing this. And it's very touching to watch that casket come off of that aircraft. They drape it with the flag,
and they really
have a lot of honor. So I applaud Delta for showing that kind
That's
of...
That's actually awesome. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I wonder if the biggest issue was she started singing when the seatbelt light was on. So we can't stand... For the national
You're
anthem.
All about context.
You
right
got a point there.
You're
got
all
a
about
point.
Context right now.
Wow. Wow. That was overthinking it. And I'm a big fan of overthinking things. Federal transportation officials have zeroed in on a potential high-speed rail route in Georgia. It would start at Hartsfield and then go through downtown Atlanta, go through North Georgia, and then terminate where? Downtown Chattanooga. And I want to applaud the producers of this show right now for resisting the temptation to drop a bit of Chattanooga choo-choo. This proposal for a high-speed rail line from Atlanta to Chattanooga now moves into a lengthy study phase. Who knows if it'll ever actually come to happen. But assuming that it does, Natalie, do you think that this seems like the route that you would have chosen for high-speed rail in the region?
I think we need so much rail, and we need light rail, and we need heavy rail, and we need underground rail. I don't know that this is, you know, I don't know that I would have chosen this before I would have chosen, for example, tying MARTA into the Emory CDC area. But if it's federal money, I will take it. It's a reasonable route. And it could also help out with some of Atlanta's kind of commuter traffic, because a lot of people live between here and Chattanooga and live in Atlanta. So I like that idea.
Yeah, a lot of, like, the wealthier residents of the Atlanta metro area live north of the city, and they would benefit from said rail line.
This would even go into some of the countryside, though. This could help out some of the smaller towns in Georgia as well.
No, I guess that's true.
And Adam,
Steve, go ahead. One of the things,
and I've studied transportation in metropolitan Atlanta just from my political perspective for 20 years, and high-speed rail, this particular project is a boondoggle. And if you look at what they're trying to do in California with high-speed rail and the billions and billions and billions and billions mm-hmm. of dollars of overruns, And the other thing you have to remember with high-speed rail, the more stops you add, the less it becomes high-speed rail.
Right. Yeah.
And what happens is everybody on that rail line wants to have a stop. That's what's happening. That's what they'd had early on in California. And you can't put the stop in every city. And there are a lot more problems that we need. I agree with Natalie's point. I would much rather do a lot of things in the heavily congested areas and solve some of those vital problems. I never hear anybody saying, my God, I'm having a hard time getting to Chattanooga.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, it's not that bad a drive to begin with.
And, earlier this year...
Well, I suppose one of the issues here is that for these federally funded projects, they have to cross state lines. Donnie, is there a route that would cross state lines you'd prefer than Atlanta and Chattanooga?
That's a very good question. I mean, earlier this year, I went to London for the first time. The high-speed rail there is just, like, so efficient, so easy, and it gets you where you need to go quickly. So I feel like it's a project we should try here in Georgia, but I don't really know how.
We should go past Tennessee. We should connect Atlanta to Charlotte, North Carolina. We should connect from there, going into Virginia, go to Richmond. Let's go.
Let's go to D.C., let's go to Chicago.
Let's do that. If we're going to spend federal money by crossing state lines, let's cross more states. Let's connect Atlanta to the East Coast.
I'll just down here in Macon wave up at all y'all and say, we'd love to get a connection too. Just letting you know.
Well, we got you.
Well, the government has no problems that our money can't solve. So, you just keep giving the money, they'll keep solving the problem.
There you go.
Dang. All right. Let's see. Wow, here's a big story. Some Decatur parents are blasting the Decatur School Board for the board's policies that are designed to protect transgender students. These parents have built a petition which says, quote, "We insist that there are areas in the education system where the anatomical sex must be the sole distinctive trait considered. In these areas, gender identity is not interchangeable with sex," end quote. This petition says that those particular areas would be athletics, locker rooms, and bathrooms. They're saying that the school system must continue to keep those areas of school activity separate on the basis of biological anatomical sex. What do folks make of that argument, Steve?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I was reading some of the articles related to this situation in Decatur, and one of the things that I think some people don't want to see is they don't want to homogenize what we consider to be traditional gender relationships. I'm not necessarily thinking it's the inclusion of other people, new gender types, or whatever we want to do, but they don't want to see the removal of some of the old gender structure if they don't want it. But I'll give you a perfect example in the athletics. There's like four cases right now in the United States where you've got someone who's anatomically male with the testosterone and everything in their system, and they're playing female athletics, and they're crushing the female teams. And a lot of people are saying that's absolutely not fair. Where do you go on something like that?
Yeah, no, but look, I wasn't sure entirely. Transgender issues are hard for me to get my brain around. But I actually talked to one of the parents in Decatur who I've known for years. She's a friend of mine, and she has a child who's 13 who just recently transitioned to being a boy. And talking to her was really helpful because it let me see this as a case of a family dealing with their child's development, not as a weapon in a culture war, but as a family trying to do what's right. She said that the Decatur schools have clear policies so that when the child made the decision to transition, there was a policy in place, what to do about pronouns, what to do about sports, what to do about bathrooms, what to do about extracurriculars. Long story short, she felt like that made the whole thing easier, and she felt like the school had her child's back. I think that as parents, we have every right to ask that schools treat our children fairly and treat them with respect. I don't think we have the right to define what that kind of respect and fair treatment looks like for other people's children.
Kalina, what do you think?
I yield my time to Natalie. Yeah, that was an excellent response there. I am all for inclusion. I am all for tolerance. I am all for understanding people's decisions on how they identify. And the more we allow our public spaces to be inclusive and safe, I think it's just going to be better in general for people.
Yeah. Donnie, last word goes to you. Question of whether schools should continue to keep some activities and areas separate on the basis of anatomical, biological, sex assigned at birth as opposed to gender identity.
I think this kind of goes back to the original topic about Woody Allen and sexual harassment, et cetera. It's like you have a group of men discussing and deciding how women should feel about a certain issue. And in this case, a lot of times they don't talk to the kids. And most times the kids are like, we don't care. It's not a big deal to us.
That's what this mom told me. She said that, you know, part of this is a generational difference. Children now and young people now talk about sexuality in a way that kind of freaks me out. In the same way that the way my generation talked about sexuality freaked my parents out.
Right, right. It's how it is. It is what it is.
Yeah, yeah. So I think if they have a serious discussion with the kids, they will see that this is a completely new generation. This is not the 1950s, the 1960s, 80s. This is a completely new generation, and they view all of these things in a different context.
And not just the children, too. Maybe talk to some transgender people, adults in the community, and just get a general idea. What is it like? Like, how do you feel about this? This is what we're trying to do.
And in Decatur, some of the parents on different sides of this issue have actually met. And my friend said that was very reassuring, that they hope that they can deal with this at a community level.
Right. That's what you want. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, with the remaining minute that we have, let's say what we're doing this weekend. Kalina, let's start with you and then go counterclockwise.
I am having my niece and nephew over, and we're going to have a slumber party. It's going to be awesome. We're going to have popcorn and pumpkin seeds roasting, and it's going to be great. Going to have fun. Hi, Christian in London.
This weekend is my college's homecoming weekend, Clark Atlanta University.
All right.
And we're turning up, as they say.
Oh, my God.
With HBCUs, it's just a big reunion, big party, and we just party with the current students and past alumni. It's going to be a ball.
And I'll be kayaking on the beautiful lakes in Fayette County this weekend, weather permitting. Mm-hmm. And I'm also looking for a queen-size sleeper sofa, so you've got my number. Tell me where I can find one.
I'll be taking my little girl to a fifth birthday party. Yay!
Nice.
Well done, well done. That's Natalie Pavelski, Vice President of Cater Communications. We also heard from Steve Brown, Commissioner for Fayette County, Kalina Bowler, host of the Credits Podcast, and filmmaker Donnie Leapart, longtime employee of Videodrome. Thank you all so much for joining us in the break room. Have yourself a great weekend.
Thank you, Adam.
Thanks, Adam.
Thank you.
And that is it for today's edition of On Second Thought, but we always want to hear from you. We talked earlier about high-speed rail. What cities in Georgia or in the broader South would you like to see linked by a fast train? Do you think that it'll ever actually happen? You can reach us at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio or tweet us at OSTTalk. You can leave us a message. Our number is 404-500-9457. And I just want to say on behalf of myself, Adam Mercusia, journalism professor at Mercer University, not employee of Georgia Public Broadcasting, I want to say thank you to everyone who contributed to GPB during their fund drive. It really, really matters. And I think that what happens at this radio station is really, really important. I'm glad that you think so, too. For the week, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Mercusia in for Celeste Headley. Talk to you next time.